They were held up in England, and the war was going on in France. And he could hear them faintly, but the explosions in his mind and the gunfire in his mind were overwhelming.
So he didn't even fire a bullet one. I mean, he didn't see any action. He didn't risk his life, but in his head, he did.
Veteran of foreign wars.
That's right. I fancied myself a leader, for had not the men of my battery given me a special token of appreciation.
And they gave him that special token because on the Lancashire, the troop ship on the way over, they could hear the mines going off, the depth charges and the artillery fire from the battleships. And the men got scared. They're down in the steel hull of this boat, and they almost did a mutiny. And Bill pulled, he was an officer, he pulled out his sidearm and squeezed off a couple rounds. Hey, boys, y'all need to settle down. They said, ooh, never know what Bill's going to do. And, you know, they thought, wow, this guy's a leader.
I wonder what kind of token they gave him.
Yeah, they probably gave him a bottle of gin.
All right. My talent for leadership, I imagined, would place me at the head of vast enterprises, which I would manage with the utmost assurance.
So ego and grandiosity's kicking in, and Bill is still, his military uniform is still dirty, and he's imagining that he's going to be placed at the head of vast enterprises. He's going to get out of the Army and go be with IBM, you know what I'm saying? He's going to be the CEO, and he says, I'd manage those things with utmost assurance. I'm Bill Wilson.
I'm the man. I took a night law course, and I obtained employment as an investigator for a surety company. The drive for success was on. I'd proved to the world that I was important.
Once again, Bill's telling you that he doesn't fit in. He never has. My parents threw me away, and I'm going to show you, by God, I'm somebody. Mm. He says, I'd prove to the world that I was important.
My work took me about Wall Street, and little by little, I became interested in the market. Many people lost money, but some became very rich. Why not I? I studied economics and business as well as law. Potential alcoholic that I was, I nearly failed my law course. One of the finals, I was too drunk to think or write. Though my drinking was not yet continuous, it disturbed my wife.
And this was at Brooklyn Law School in 1920. Bill was just trying to find his niche. And he did get his law degree, but he never picked it up. Law was not for him.
Bill talks about, it disturbed my wife. Oh, I got married. Bill met Lois Burnham, came from money. Her dad, Clark Burnham, was a doctor, and they had a vacation home on Emerald Lake just outside of East Dorset. And they came up every summer, and she was out of his league, and he knew it, and she knew it, and everybody knew it. But Bill's a little tenacious little guy, and he would wear him down and wear her down and wear her down. And finally, she just kind of gave in. And right before he shipped off to the war, they got married in a Swedborgian ceremony. There was a little kind of rushed because of everything going on, but all of a sudden Bill had a family now. Clark Burnham took over the place of his father, and her mom took over the place in a very loved relationship. Bill loved Lois's mother. They accepted him wholeheartedly, thought he was a little weird.
He says, though my drinking was not yet continuous, because you know it's coming.
Uh-huh. It did to disturb Lois. We had long talks when I would steal her forebodings by telling her, you know, men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk, Lois. That the most majestic constructions of philosophic thought were so derived.
So this is rationalization to Lois. I can remember back in the day when I was running and gunning, and they'd say, don't you think you're doing a little bit too much of that stuff? Oh, no. I'm a thinking guy. I'm an idea guy.
I've heard this way too many times to discount it because I know it's truth. Something happens about 2:30 in the morning sitting at the bar. You've got it all figured out in the back of a bar napkin, you know, the plan for life, the way to $1 million, the world peace. I got it all figured out, and then you set your drink down on the napkin, and it's ruined. Oh, well, I'll just start again tomorrow. It says, by the time I completed the course, I knew the law was not for me.
Never picked up his law degree.
The inviting maelstrom of Wall Street had me in its grip.
Maelstrom is a storm. It's a whirlwind. He loved the excitement.
Business and financial leaders were my heroes. Out of this alloy of drink and speculation, I commenced to forge the weapon that one day would turn in its flight like a boomerang and all but cut me to ribbons. Living modestly, my wife and I saved $1,000. It went into certain securities, then cheap and rather unpopular. I rightly imagine that they would someday have a great rise. I failed to persuade my broker friends to send me out looking over factories and managements, but my wife and I decided to go anyways. I developed a theory that most people lost money in stocks through ignorance of the markets. I discovered many more reasons later on. It's a prelude to buying on margin. Anybody can identify with getting something on credit or running a tab or fronted when they looking for the money and you ain't got it. Well, when they pulled up, and we're in the same situation now, they've extended lines of credit to people who couldn't pay on them. And our financial markets have taken a huge hit, and it's no different now than it was in 1929. So says, we gave up our positions and off we roared on a motorcycle, sidecar stuff, a tent, blankets, and a change of clothes, three huge volumes of a Moody Financial Reference Service.
This old motorcycle is a 1919 Harley. Bill bought it for a couple hundred dollars. And there's some Harley guys in here, and we all know that Harley-Davidson was probably the most unreliable piece of machinery ever built up until the mid-80s. They left to mark their territory everywhere you parked them. And this thing was a click above a pea shooter. It had a big old sidecar on it, and they had gone to a Army-Navy store and bought a bunch of Army tarpaulins that were made of rubber and heavy fabric, weighed a lot. And Lois made rain jackets and ponchos and a tent and all this stuff, and they had it all in that sidecar. And this car, this thing's made of steel. This isn't any polycarbonate body. And Bill's sitting up there on it like he's the man. Well, the fact is, Bill was drunk in the sidecar most of the time, and Lois was riding the damn thing. But he was a good tinkerer, and he could keep this old machine running. Now, we got to get our minds around this a little bit, guys. They jumped on this thing in East Dorset, Vermont, and they rode it south to Tampa, Florida. And they did this in April of 25. There were no highways. There was no I-95 or 75. Very few roads were paved. And if you ran over a spur of any kind, a sand spur, it punctured the tires. They were soft latex. So they were changing the tire on this thing sometimes twice a day. I know that I've got Lois's diary of this trip where she liked to go fast, and she'd get on a downgrade with all that weight, and she got it up to about 65 miles an hour one time. And that thing's vibrating and ginning so hard the carburetor fell off of it. And she had to get Bill out of his stupor to put the carburetor back on. But if you can just get your brain around this piece of machinery, I wouldn't ride it from here to the store up there if I needed a beer real bad. I mean, this was a piece of junk. And they took this trip all the way to Tampa, Florida to visit Bill's parents or Bill's mother.
It says, our friends thought a lunacy commission should be appointed. Perhaps they were right. I had had some success at speculation, so we had a little money. But we once worked on a farm for a month to avoid drawing on our small capital. That was the last honest manual labor on my part for many a day.
They had $4 left, and this was in July of 1935. They started out in April, and they'd gone through their money. They had $4 left, and they went to work for a farm, a guy that owned a farm. And they didn't want to hire him because Lois was not a good cook. But Bill put the sales pitch on him, and he says, I'll work on your farm equipment and let Lois help the lady clean the house. And that's what they did. So they worked there for a month, and earned $93.25.
We covered the whole eastern U.S. in a year. At the end of it, my reports to Wall Street procured me a position there in the use of a large expense account. The exercise of an option brought in more money, leaving us with a profit of several thousand dollars for that year. For the next few years, fortune threw money and applause my way. I had arrived.
There it is. You want to highlight and underline that, because Bill, he has been doing all he could. Tell him about some of the things he did in high school, Christian, as far as the band and that.
Bill was average athlete, but when he found out that he could become the pitcher of the baseball team at the school in Manchester, he became the captain of the team, became their top performer, and then he grabbed a hold of an old fiddle and started playing on it and became first chair in the orchestra and master the best in the debate club and the best in this and the best in that. And basically, once he got to be the best, well, I got to find something else to be best at because I've already topped this. So it had to be this, 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 and this. And he's just anything that he could do to put himself above and beyond. And see if you can relate to this. It wasn't about being best. It was about you recognizing that he was best.
Bill had gone to the best on Wall Street, and he said, guys, I've got this theory. If I can get inside the research and development departments of these large corporations, General Electric and Portland Cement, and find out what they're doing that's innovative, that they're about to introduce, we might be able to give our investors that inside information and help them with a wise buy or purchase on their stocks. And they thought he was nuts.
And they call that insider trading now.
Yeah, a little insider. But he was right. And you see, it says, leaving us with a profit of several thousand dollars for that year.
All right, next paragraph continues by saying, my judgment and ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions. There's an old commercial. What does it say? When E.F. Hutton talks, people listen. Bill Wilson made a lot of people very rich. He was a risky investment, but his risks were paying off. And this is the 20s. I mean, it was as aggressive and as prosperous a market in our nation's history. I mean, we were right there. I mean, it was the jazz age. This is 5 years before the 4 years before the market tanked. And it was keep going, and a lot of people got real rich real quick with very little effort. And Bill Wilson thought he touched everything and it turned to gold. And they were convinced of that, you know. So, it says, the great boom of the late 20s was seething and swelling. Drink was taking an important and exhilarating part in my life.
Please highlight that, because there's another timeline on the progression of Bill Wilson's alcoholism. It was taking an important, that's the key word, an exhilarating part in my life.
There was loud talk in the jazz places uptown. Everyone spent in thousands and chattered in millions. Scoffers could scoff and be damned. I made a host of fair-weathered friends.
Can y'all hook up with that? You know, when you had that big sack and that good stuff, that single malt and all that, and everybody was around. Oh, Bob, you're such a nice guy. And then all of a sudden, all the stuff was gone, and you look around, everybody's gone.
Yeah.
So where'd everybody go?
Well, you're out of stuff, aren't you?
Yeah. Yeah. Give us a question if you get some more.
Did anybody in here ever steal their buddy's stuff, and then they're amazed when they recognize it's gone, and then you help them look for it? You know, they're like, oh, man, it was here a minute ago. God, you know, I'll help you look for it the whole time. You're like, damn, I can't wait to get out of here.
So he's got this host of fair-weather friends. They're just hanging on to him for what he's got and what he's able to do for them.
And, again, this is Prohibition time. So all these jazz places, all these places that he's doing his drinking, he was invited to go to. He was Wall Street's golden boy, man. He was making a lot of people wealthy real quick, and they were like, listen, I want you to come in on my speakeasy dime, and, you know, we're going to hook you up, Bill Wilson, because you're magic, and what you touch turns to gold.
Bill was probably not a very easy guy to get along with. Very, you know.
He's got an answer for everything.
Yeah.
He knows it all. You can't tell him nothing. That sounds a lot like me, you know. Says, my drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night.
There's another sign of his progression.
The remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf.
All right, remonstrances. That's a protest. A row, R-O-W. The word fits is a row, like they all terminated in a row, but it's a row. And a row is a fight or disagreement. And he says he became a lone wolf. He had finally crossed the line. Nobody wanted anything to do with him. They're looking at this guy, and they say, you know, you got the world by the tail. And you're drinking like a dog. You're flushing all this down the toilet. We don't want anything to do with you. You're just too difficult to be around, Bill.
Now, there were many unhappy scenes in our sumptuous apartment. There had been no real infidelity, for loyalty to my wife, helped at times by extreme drunkenness, kept me out of those scrapes.
You know, I believe everything in this book. I really do. I just need to find out what his definition of real infidelity was.
It's like Clinton's definition of sex, right? You know, what is sex? You know, come on, you know. And if you're drunk and too drunk to remember it, did it really happen? You know, did I read about it? She took advantage of me. 1929, I contracted Gulf fever. I sponsor a number of men who have succumbed to this disease, and it's an ugly, ugly manifestation of alcoholism. it's an expensive disease. Bill Weld, they say, we went at once to the country, my wife to applaud while I started out to overtake Walter Hagen.
Walter Hagen was the Tiger Woods of the day and also alcoholic. Mm. Bill loved him. Hagen's slogan was 69 every day and a fifth every night. Mm.
Liquor caught up with me, though, much faster than I came up behind Walter. Uh-huh. I began to be jittery in the morning.
Yep.
Golf permitted drinking every day and every night.
Wonder why Bill liked to play golf. Mm-hmm.
It was fun to carry him around the exclusive course which had inspired such awe in me as a lad. Now, Bill grew up in East Dorset, Vermont. He had walked to Manchester, Vermont. He would go to school there, and every time he walked there, every day, he'd walk by the big black wrought iron gates and the manicured lawns of the Manchester Country Club. And he knew beyond a shadow of a doubt he would never be a member there. He would never experience what it is that these well-to-do experience. He would never taste the sumptuous food. He would never know the exquisite joy of teeing off on one of these beautiful greens. And yet, here he is. He's enjoying the finer life. Finally arrived.
We discussed it last night. I was talking with somebody in here about it. Bill was not a blue blood. Bill's dad was a miner. And he was surrounded. Because East Dorset, at one time, was a mining town. All of a sudden, Emerald Lake drew the blue bloods in, the doctors and the well-to-do. And he wanted to fit in there, but he knew he never would. So hence, once he was thrown away, he became an overachiever. And he just overdid everything, and he's arrived at this point.
He says, I acquired the impeccable coat of tan one sees upon the well-to-do. The local banker watched me whirl fat checks in and out of his till with amused skepticism. Abruptly, in October of 1929, all hell broke loose on the New York Stock Exchange. After one of those days of inferno, I wobbled from a hotel bar to a brokerage office. It was 8 o'clock, 5 hours after the market closed. Ticker still clattered. I'm staring at an inch of the tape which bore the inscription XYZ down 32. XYZ is a reference to Pinnock and Ford. It's a grain products company. And Bill Wilson looked at a number of companies like Pinnock and Ford, GE, Portland Cement. And Portland Cement and GE were really booming. Pinnock and Ford, though, was something it was the underdog. It was his dark horse, and he was going to put all of his time, effort, and investment in. The majority of his margins were put on Pinnock and Ford. And everybody who'd sit down long enough, you listen, Pinnock and Ford, grain products, they're working with these guys up in Battle Creek, Michigan, and they're doing these things with Kellogg's, making these amazing products, man, and you got to wait till you try this. And had it worked, it would have set him up for life. But it didn't, so he went back to the bar. It says, it had been 52 that morning. I was finished, and so were many friends. The papers reported men jumping to death from the towers of high finance.
Notice the words high finance are capitalized. Money God.
I wouldn't jump. I went back to the bar. Oh,
that
disgusted me. Yeah.
That's my guy, kind of guy. I'm not going to
How can
jump.
You give up so easily? Let's go drink. My friends had dropped several million since 10 o'clock. So what? Tomorrow's another day.
Come on, Scarlett.
As I drank, that old fierce determination to win came back.
As he drank, what happened is the allergy set in. He calls it fierce determination. Once he started drinking, he didn't have a choice.
Yeah.
Let's go get the kids out of the road, Ethel. I'm driving home.
When I lived in a homeless shelter downtown Atlanta, something would happen after a few sips of beer. You know, you get a little nip of some vodka in the morning. And all of a sudden, I'm pulling up the tie around my neck. You know, I'm thinking, I'm looking good. And I'm looking behind me, and I don't recognize that it's a homeless shelter. But something about that old fierce determination that came back, you know, I got this. You know, I'm going to walk in, and I'm going to wow these guys. And they're going to hire me because they see I am high caliber. Now, I'm looking down at my busted up shoes, this raggedy thrift store suit. But guess what? Through these eyes, when alcohol had infused itself in my brain, I was $1 million. That old fierce determination to win came back. He says, next morning I telephoned my friend in Montreal.
This guy's name was Dick Johnson. If I had been this guy, I'd gone to the courthouse and changed my name. Dick Johnson. What happened when the stock market crashed in the United States in 29, it had a reverse effect in Canada. It was going off the scale. Well, Bill was renowned internationally for his talent in the stock market. So he gave this guy, Dick, a call. He says, hey, dude, I need a job. He says, come on.
Dick had plenty of money left and thought I'd better go to Canada. Now, by the following spring, we were living in our accustomed style.
In his accustomed style, Bill had a sumptuous apartment, he called it, back in a page or so ago, in New York. And if you have any idea what the lifestyle costs in New York, given that day and today's day, I mean, it's exorbitant. So, but what he did is he got this big one-bedroom apartment and another one-bedroom apartment, tore down the wall and made this huge apartment in Brooklyn. And, I mean, Bill, and for all intents and purposes, was a millionaire in this day and age. And so he had lost it all because of the crash, and he goes to Montreal and he says, here, you know, by the following spring, we were living in our accustomed style because Bill's a mover and shaker. He was up there making things happen.
Says, I felt like Napoleon returning from Elba. No St. Helena for me. But drinking caught up with me again. My generous friend had let me go. This time we stayed broke.
So there's another timeline on his drinking. He, by this time, Bill is to a point to where when he starts drinking, he can't stop. And when Bill starts drinking, all the walls come down every time. Yeah. So he's got another shot at success.
And think about the risk here. Bill Wilson made Dick Johnson a lot of money. The risk of keeping him employed was greater than the money he was bringing in, and he was bringing in a lot. Think about that. He willingly threw away a moneymaker because the embarrassment, the risk, the ridicule, and all the stories about Bill Wilson cost him more than the money he was bringing in. And in today, man, you know, we got some people like Bernie Madoff and a whole bunch of other guys running around this planet who made a lot of people a lot of money, and there ain't too many people who want to see that, those guys walking around alive anymore. You know, it's like they have these opportunities to make something of themselves, and it's just too risky because our alcoholism just kills it. So, doing what all heroes do, he says, we went to live with my wife's parents.
There you go.
I found a job, and then I lost it. As a result of a brawl with the taxi driver.
When E.F. Hutton speaks, people listen.
Except the taxi driver.
And here's a guy that has made it all. He's well-respected around the planet. And he gets into a brawl with a New York City cab driver. How do you do that? And he lost his job over it, so it must have been more than a few words, you know?
Mercifully, no one would guess I was to have no real employment for 5 years or hardly draw a sober breath.
That's a good timeline. Bill stays drunk at this point for 5 years straight.
Lois began to come to work in a department store, coming home exhausted to find me drunk. I became an unwelcome hanger-on at brokerage places.
What's happening here? Lois goes and gets a job at Macy's, making $22.50 a week. And she's also putting herself through school because she had an interest in interior design. So Bill, he can't get a job. And what he's doing is he's getting this insider information and showing up at the brokerage firms over on Wall Street. And they're saying, Bill, please don't come around here anymore. You stink. You're unshaven. Your suit's unkept. Please don't come around here like this anymore, Bill. So he became an unwelcome hanger-on at brokerage places, the place where fame and fortune threw Wallace's his way.
Yeah. And Bill Wilson was one of those types. I mean, I've heard stories that are similar to it. And there's a story of a guy, a member of our fellowship out in California. He actually made such huge investments to this particular college that they actually had two buildings named after him and one after his father. And he went back to these colleges trying to get a job. And they threw him out of the very building that bore his name. You get out of here. Bill Wilson basically was doing the same thing. He had made these Wall Street tycoons so much money that they're throwing him out of the very office which is furnished with the money that Bill Wilson made them. Get off this damn carpet and get out of my office. And he's like, but I paid for that carpet. You know, I mean, as he's walking by these sumptuous built offices with the fine oak furniture and fine, you know, and he's walking by these cars that Bill Wilson put these cars in these guys' pockets, put all this success in their pockets. Get out of here. Don't come back here. Don't show your face here anymore. You know, you're just too much of an embarrassment. And then Bill does something. He acknowledges something here, and I don't know if anybody can relate to this, but something happened where it stopped being fun. You know, my mom always used to tell me, she says, Chris, you just party too much. And I'm thinking, God, the party's been over for a long time. This ain't a party anymore. And Bill writes it so eloquently. He says, liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity.
He's no longer drinking because he wants to. He's drinking because he has to. Mm. And there's another timeline in the progression of the alcoholism as it's manifested in this man's life.
Bathtub gin. 2 bottles a day, and often 3, got to be routine.
Bathtub gin.
Mm.
Hmm. Got a feeling that's probably a little stronger than 80 proof, don't y'all? And bottles, I doubt very seriously that he's referring to half pints. Kirk, you think?
Nope.
They're probably handle jugs.
You bet.
Handle jugs and a straw.
Come on. I says, sometimes a small deal would net a few $100s, and I'd pay my bills at the bars and delicatessens.
Now, that's a real stand-up guy. He'd go out and he'd put together a little deal, and he wouldn't pay Edison any money for the lights or help Lois with the groceries. He's got to go pay the man. He's got to pay the bars and delicatessens because he's got a little line of credit to keep his Jones going, see?
Come on.
Real stand-up guy, this Bill Wilson. I know.
This went on endlessly, and I began to waken very early in the morning, shaking violently. The delirium DTs are starting in. A tumbler full of gin. How many former bartenders in here? I was one. A tumbler full of gin. Tumbler, that's an ample amount. Yeah, about 12 to 14 ounces.
He'd drink a tumbler full of gin, and how many?
A half dozen.
He'd drink a tumbler and a six-pack before he would be required if he could eat his Cheerios.
Yeah.
Can you imagine this? Slinging Wheaties everywhere?
So you got 12 to 14 ounces. He does not mention ice cubes. So we got gin, and we got that non-regulated pre-6% beer. So it's, you know, anywhere from 10 to 15% alcohol. So he's got enough to where, which is a good start for us, you know. Full glass of gin and a six-pack, probably closer to 10 or 12 actual beers, just to eat, just to calm the body down enough so I can sit in a chair and put a spoon in my hand and make it to my mouth.
Bill's qualified to be here, y'all.
Mm-hmm. But here it is. Nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And there were periods of sobriety which would renew my wife's hopes.
Those periods of sobriety were little escapes to the country, which we're gonna allude to here in a few minutes, but they would leave New York City and get out into the country.
Mm-hmm.
And, he'd get sober because there wasn't any bars around.
Here's a promise. Gradually, things got worse.
Nice.
The house was taken over by the mortgage holder. My mother-in-law died. My wife and father-in-law became ill. Bill's, we mentioned earlier, Bill's mother-in-law, Lois's mom, he loved her. He was too drunk to go to her funeral. And it devastated and haunted him. And it fueled his drinking for a number of years after this. He says, then I got that promising business opportunity. Stocks were at a low point in 1932. I had somehow formed a group to buy. I was to share generously in the profits. Then I went on a prodigious bender, and the chance vanished.
What happened? Bill somehow had formed this group of well-to-dos, and the business meeting took place in New York, in New Jersey. And they told him right up front. They said, "Bill, you can be a superstar again, and we'll allow you to be right up at the head of the food chain here. But you need to know we're aware of your drinking problem." And if you start drinking, you're out. They're sitting around this conference table, and somebody pulled a cork out of a jug and took a pull off of it, and they said, "My God, this is the best Applejack I have ever had in my life." Somebody said, "Applejack?" He says, "Yeah, this is New Jersey Lightning. This best Applejack I ever had. You want to hit, Bill?" "No, I'm good. So it went around the table, and this other fella pulled on it, and he said, "My God almighty."
Mm.
He said, "This stuff is awesome. I ain't never had nothing like this." Bill says, "You know what? I think I will have a
never
sip of
that."
Never had an Applejack. "I think I'll have a sip." And it says here he went on a prodigious bender, and that chance vanished. They said, "You're out of here, dude."
But what's really sad is that his investors still took his ideas and made money off of it.
Yeah.
I mean, basically, you wake up and your car is gone, your wallet's gone, and you think, "Damn, did I have a good time? I'm not sure." Bill did. He says, "I woke up. This had to be stopped."
Doesn't mean he woke up from sleep. He's like bringing himself. He says, "You know what? I'm in a bad spot here. It had to be stopped.
I saw I could not take so much as even one drink."
This is Bill's first real try at willpower, if you want to make that note in your margin.
"I was through forever." Famous last words.
Before then, I'd written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed, this time I meant business, and so I did.
I don't know out here in the West, but in the South, we used to have a thing called the Family Bible, and it laid in a common place in a home. In our home, it was a big, thick, white Bible, leather-bound, and Mama would always have it up on a little easel-like thing, open to it to the day's passage with a little ribbon down there. And that these Bibles had the red writing in it and the black writing. And what Bill would do is he would write these promises to Lois. November 12th, today, I swear, Lois, this is it. I'm finished. I'm never drinking again. And he kept doing that.
November 15th, November 19th.
Yeah. And then finally he got to where he would prick his finger and he would write these promises in his own blood. Mm. He had written lots of sweet promises to my wife, and she happily observed, this time I meant business, and so I did.
Mm. Shortly afterwards, I came home drunk.
Willpower failed.
There'd been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone pushed a drink my way, I'd taken it. Was I crazy?
Yep.
I began to wonder if such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. Renewing my resolve, I tried again. Some time passed, and confidence began to be replaced by cocksureness.
And so he went from self-will to self-confidence. I'm Bill Wilson. Look what I've done.
Now I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes.
With an exclamation point.
I got this. One day I'm walking into the cafe to telephone. In no time I'm beating on the bar, asking myself how it happened.
Yeah.
As the whiskey rose to my head,
that's when that allergy set in.
I told myself I could manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk now.
That's my kind of guy. I love Bill Wilson.
Now, the remorse, the horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity. I hardly dare even cross the street lest I collapse and be run down by an early morning truck, for it was scarcely daylight. An all-night place supplied me with a dozen glasses of ale. God, my writhing nerves were stilled at last.
So he's drank a 12-pack.
Or more. Mm-hmm. A morning paper told me the market had gone to hell again. Well, so had I. Oh, boy, that little self-pity starts in on him. The market would recover, but I wouldn't. That's a hard thought. Should I kill myself?
No.
Then that mental fog settled down. Gin would fix that, so two bottles and oblivion.
Two bottles of gin. He drank a 12-pack or so. He grabs a couple of handle jugs. I love this guy.
The mind and body are marvelous mechanisms. Mine endured this agony two more years.
So we've got about 9 years stacked up here at this point.
All in all, Bill basically, Bill didn't start drinking until he was 19 years old, and he roughly drank for 20 years. Dr. Bob, to put into perspective, drank for 32 years. So he did a whole lot of drinking in 20 years here. He says, sometimes I stole from my wife's slender purse when the morning terror and madness were on me.
Can y'all relate to that morning terror and madness? Mm. Or do you think this is just some words in a book? Can y'all relate to that?
Again, I swayed dizzily before an open window of the medicine cabinet where there was poison, cursing myself for a weakling.
Cursing myself for a weakling. That was about as low a blow as Bill could get.
Yeah.
Because he was the man. He had proved to the world that he was the man.
There were flights from city to country and back as my wife and I sought escape. Then came the hellish night. And then came the night when the physical and mental torture was so hellish I feared I would burst through my window, sash and all.
Now, Bill says there were flights from city to country. If you ever read anything by Lois or by Bill, they had a pretty amorous love affair, or love, physical, sexual relationship. And they liked to go out under the stars and make love, and they would escape. They'd go up to the Green Lake, Emerald Lake, and they would camp out. And that's that thing that today they call it geographical cure. Mm-hmm. And he says, the night came when the physical and mental torture was so hellish I feared I would burst through my window sash and all. He says, somehow I managed to drag my mattress to a lower floor, lest I suddenly leap. And it sounds like he did that for a night, but Bill actually lived in the basement on this mattress for around a month.
Now, Bill's timeline here, if you ever read the original version of Bill's story, he cut out about 10 pages. You know, so, I mean, there's a 16-page story. It's one of the longest in the book. But he cut out 10 pages, so there's parts of his story that kind of overlap one another, because this is a reference also to the last parts of his drinking. And we're not, you know, this is in the
talking about a year before, he's kind of putting little parts of it that kind of overlap. So if you're following a straight timeline, it won't make sense because parts of this will overlap one another. He says, somehow I managed, says a doctor came with a heavy sedative.
Yeah, baby. This is Dr. Leonard Strong. This was his brother-in-law. Leonard Strong married his sister Dorothy.
Next day found me drinking both gin and sedative.
My kind of guy.
This combination soon landed me on the rock. People feared for my sanity, so did I. I could eat little or nothing when drinking, and I was 40 pounds underweight.
Keep in mind, Bill Wilson, 6'3", 6'4". Very tall, very thin, handsome guy. And at this stage of the game, Bill is drinking heavy booze and heavy sedative. And he's in bad shape. He's at the end of his run. And if you follow what he says here, he says, I could eat little or nothing when drinking. So the tumbler of gin and a dozen bottles of beer ain't helping no more. And I was 40 pounds underweight. If you have a pen, write in your margin that Bill's dying. Bill is dying an alcoholic death. His liver is already distended. He's jaundiced. Bill's sick. Hmm. Bill's dying an alcoholic death. Alcoholic death's a pretty bad dude.
Yeah. I remember this one of the guys I used to drink with, I never saw him eat. I would grab a burger or something, come and finish drinking. But I never saw him eat. I asked him one night. I was just like, you never eat. And he'd just look at me straight, seriously, and say, doctor said nothing but liquids. So my brother-in-law is a physician, and through his kindness and that of my mother, I was placed in a nationally known hospital for the mental and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics.
This is in the summer of 1933, and this is Charlie Towns Hospital. I know up here in the Great Northwest, it ain't going to mean a hill of beans to y'all, but we found out a few weeks ago that Charlie Towns was actually from Georgia. He was actually from Claxton, Georgia.
Under the so-called belladonna treatment, my brain cleared. Hydrotherapy and mild exercise helped much. Best of all, I met a kind doctor who explained that though certainly selfish and foolish, I had been seriously ill, bodily and mentally.
The belladonna treatment, that's an antispasmodic. Belladonna comes from the nightshade family. It's actually toxic, but it helps with delirium tremens. It's still used in medicine today. He says, best of all, this is highlighted in my book, and I invite you to do the same. I met a kind doctor, that's Dr. Silkworth, who explained that certainly selfish, remember we talk about it in the book, that selfishness, self-centeredness, we think is the root of our problem. He says, and I had been foolish, I had been seriously ill, bodily, allergy, mentally, obsession. Okay? So that's where Silkworth told him what the problem was.
He writes, it relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly, even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge.
So self-knowledge, we've tried self-confidence, we've tried self-will, and now we're going to try self-knowledge. And this little deal on goose hung high. To have a goose hang high in preparation for eating during this depression era was a sign of having good fortune or wealth. Also thought to be a form of an old myth or superstition that when geese flew low, it meant that evil spirits were present. When the geese flew high, it meant that the evil spirits were gone and all was well. This was, in this usage, hung would mean flew. In short, the evil had passed and all was well again. The goose hung high.
But it wasn't. The frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to Towns Hospital. This was the finish, the curtain, it seemed to me. My wary and despairing wife was informed that it would all end with heart failure during DTs.
This is the summer of 1934.
Or I would develop a wet brain, perhaps within a year. She'd soon have to give me over to the undertaker or to the asylum. They didn't need to tell me. I knew and almost welcomed the idea. Oh, here it is. Last shred of dignity. It was a devastating blow to my pride.
I, who had thought so well of myself and my abilities, of my capacity to surmount obstacles, was cornered at last. Now I was to plunge into the dark, joining that endless procession of sots who had gone on before. I thought of my poor wife, Lois. There had been much happiness, after all. What would I not give to make amends?
Oh.
But that was over now. Damn, man.
And so, this little paragraph that Chris is about to read, in my opinion, is probably the best description of the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous ever. And September of 1987, actually December of 1987, my brother, who's going on to the big meeting, gave me this book that's laying in front of me. He placed my hand in yours. But when he gave me this book, he put a paper clip on this page. And he bracketed this next paragraph. I ran with my brother. I knew what he was and what he was capable of. And he knew that when he gave me this book, he didn't preach. He just gave me the book. So I love you, bud. I said, I love you too, man. He knew I was going to go home and go to that paperclip. And he knew I was going to read what he bracketed. And here's what it said. He knew I would hook up.
No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master.
Sounds like the first step, doesn't it? So if you would, you might want to bracket or whatever and write that out. This is Bill's first step.
I like he starts off his next line, trembling.
So dramatic.
I'm scared, man. I stepped from the hospital a broken man. Fear sobered me for a bit.
So he's scared now because he knows he's dying.
Then came the insidious insanity that first drink on Armistice Day or Veterans Day, which was November 11th, 1934, 1 month prior to his last drink. I was off again.
All right, so Bill, he's feeling a little better. He decides he's going to go out and play a round of golf. He borrows his Dr. Strong's clubs and goes out to the country club on his brother-in-law's membership to play around. And it's Armistice Day, so he gets on the bus and he's riding along, and all of a sudden this guy gets on carrying a rifle. Bill says, "Where are you going with that gun?" Guy says, "Well, I'm a competition shooter. There's a competition out at the country club today, and I'm gonna go out there and shoot in it." He said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Well, I'm gonna go out and shoot around the golf." So during the bus ride, Bill starts telling him what a phenomenal human being he is, how strong-willed he is, how he kicked alcoholism, and how he had been up here and lost it all and was on his way back. And the guy says, "My God Almighty, you're a hell of a guy, Bill. I've never met anybody with the moral fiber you've got."
Bill says,
"That's right." So the bus breaks down, and they go into a coffee shop and grab a cup of coffee, and another bus comes along, gets them, takes them to the country club. Well, they get out there, and guy says, "You know, my competition doesn't start for an hour." And Bill says, "Yeah, I got about that much time before my tea time. You want to grab a sandwich?" So they go around to the restaurant. Restaurant's closed because it's Armistice Day. Groundskeeper comes up and says, "You know, if you go around the back, there's a pro shop back there, and you can probably get a sandwich in there." They went around there and walked in the door, and the bartender took two big old glasses of whiskey and set it on the bar and says, "Happy Armistice Day, boys. Have one on the house." This is on Armistice Day. I was off again.
Says everyone became resigned to the certainty that I would have to be shut up somewhere, or I would stumble along to a miserable end. How dark it is before the dawn. In reality, that was the beginning of my last debauch. I was soon to be catapulted into what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence.
Bill mentioned this fourth dimension a couple of times, and I'm going to give you the definitions of this. You're welcome to write them, or if you just want to listen.
And this is an alcoholic's interpretation of the four dimensions. If you were to go online and type in four dimensions, you're probably going to get a number of different ones, but we got this from an alcoholic we know, love, and respect, and so we figured we would share these with you.
All I got to do is find it. Here we go. The first dimension is physical. It's height, length, and width. The second dimension is time, past, present, and future. Third dimension is mental, thought, perception, and feeling. And the fourth is a spiritual dimension, a conscious contact with God. Anybody need me to repeat that?
Is that in that old dictionary?
Sir?
Mm-mm. Is that in that old dictionary?
No.
No. The first one is physical, height, length, and width. Second is time, past, present, and future. Third is mental, thought, perception, and feeling. And the fourth is the spiritual dimension, conscious contact with God. Again, good?
Cool.
Third one is mental, thought, perception, and feeling. We did this last weekend over in Ireland, and it had about 150 women in there. What? Hey. Eh? Again? Doing book studies with guys is a whole different animal than doing it with women.
Huh?
Eh? Could you repeat that? What does that mean?
Come again?
Come again. Does that apply to women? Yep. It applies because of you. If you had my wife, you'd drink too.
Says, I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. Now, near the end of that bleak November, I sat drinking in my kitchen. With a certain satisfaction, I reflected there was enough gin concealed about the house to carry me through that night and the next day. They've done renovations on 182 Clinton Street in Brooklyn Heights and on Ardmore Avenue in Akron. And in the renovations, they pulled down these old plaster walls and they found bottles hidden by Bill and Bob that they forgot, you know? I mean, just these dusty old gin bottles hidden back there.
You know, Charlie Parmalee, our predecessor, he was telling me one time, he said that he'd sold his farm over in Arkansas, and the guy that bought it, they would pass every now and then on a little dirt road, and the guy would wave him down and say, Charlie, you know, I tore down that fence over on the back 40. He says, and there was a few hollow fence posts, and we got some liquor bottles that you stuck down in there you might want back. So I said, that's all right.
Yeah.
Thanks for letting me know.
My wife was at work. I wondered whether I dared hide a full bottle of gin near the head of our bed. I would need it before daylight.
See, there's the hook right there. He doesn't say I might want it. Might like a sip. He's going to need it because the DTs are going to set in before morning.
Mm-hmm. My musing was interrupted by the telephone. The cheery voice of an old school friend asked if he might come over. He was sober.
This guy that called is Ebby Thatcher. Edwin Throckmorton Thatcher, another blue blood from the Northeast. He had run with Bill. And he wasn't just an old school friend. These boys run together. I mean, they were drinking buddies. And Ebby was one of the blue bloods that Bill hooked up with because he was not a blue blood, once again. His family owned Thatcher Ironworks. They made railroad wheels for the train system. His father's brother donated a piece of land in downtown Albany and turned it into a park. So these guys had lots and lots and lots of money. And I love Ebby Thatcher. This guy, he's a scream.
He says it was years since I could remember him coming to New York in that condition.
In other words, he hadn't been sober in a while.
I was amazed. Rumor had it he'd been committed for alcoholic insanity. Mm-hmm. I wonder how he had escaped. Bill doesn't allude to what. Escaped what? The commitment or the alcoholic insanity? Of course we would have dinner and then I could drink openly with him.
Gives me permission to drink and act the way I want to act.
Unmindful of Ebby's welfare, I thought only of recapturing the spirit of other days. You know, there was that time we chartered an airplane to complete a jag.
You know, that sounds awfully romantic that they chartered an airplane. Well, what really happened, they were in a bar drinking. And they ran into an old pilot in there by the name of Ted Burke. And Ted was an alcoholic, too. He liked to drink whiskey and show himself. So Ted says, hey, fellas, y'all want to go for a little airplane ride? And he said, you betcha.
Yeah.
So they go out, and they get in this old airplane. Talking about the 30s here. And maybe even the 20s, who knows. But they get in this old airplane. All three of them are drunk. And one of them probably said something like, hey, dude, I got to pee. And Ted goes, well, you know, they just built a brand new airstrip over here in Manchester, Vermont. We can set her down over there and you can get out and relieve yourself. Well, it just so happened that day they were having a ceremony, a ribbon cutting for this airstrip. The mayor's out there and they got this bandstand, the high school band, the majorettes, the streamers. So this old drunk pilot radios in and says, get the kids out of the road, boys, we're setting her down. This old airplane comes in there, and it probably, this is in my mind's eye, probably makes a one-pointer. Bam, bam, bam. And it comes to rest on this grassy airstrip. And so Ebby looks over at Bill. They documented this conversation. He said, what are we going to do? Bill says, well, we got to do something. And they opened the door, and Ebby and Bill didn't step out of the plane. They fell out of the plane. The band's playing, and the bear's up on the thing. So that's how Manchester Airport was opened. And they didn't charter anything. They went on a little air train kick. That was in Manchester, Vermont.
Ebby's coming was an oasis in the dreary desert of futility. The very thing, an oasis. Drinkers are like that.
Yeah, you know what? Yeah, let's do 5 minutes and we'll come back and talk about Ebby's visit with Bill.
Let me know when you get ready.
We're at the tail end of November. Bottom of page 8 says, my musing was interrupted by the telephone. The cheery voice of an old school friend asked if he might come over. He was sober. That's where we're at. So now, we're going to skip down one full paragraph. We've already talked about Bill and Ebby doing their completing a jag. It says, the door opened and he stood there, fresh-skinned and glowing. There was something about Ebby's eyes. Ebby was inexplicably different. What had happened? You know that look that you get when you show up somewhere and you're sober and they don't remember you being sober and they look at your eyes a little different? They're looking for the roadmap that ain't on your eyes anymore. Them cracked lines, those red rims, it's not there. That's how my mom used to tell if I was serious about it, because she heard me talk about being serious. But then she would do this thing. She'd kind of get up and look real quick. Okay, all right. I believe it. You look like you're sober. And I'm thinking, damn, why is she staring so much in my eyes? She hadn't seen them in years. That's the reason why.
John, are you on the floor back there, son? Short. You're just short?
It's always the short guy that's got to point out the short guy. You
that's
know that?
Why you give everybody so much trouble. It's that Napoleon thing, isn't it?
If you spot it, you got it.
You know, back home... You've taken a lot of shots at me this weekend. You ain't been around me long. But back home, they would classify you as a dick with ears. And it's on. He's thinking, yeah. I love you, dude.
Hey, remember, the only bad press is no press. So you're getting a little love from up here. So Bill's staring at Ebby's eyes, and he asks the question, what had happened? He says, I pushed a drink across the table. Ebby refused it. Disappointed, but curious. I wondered what had gotten into this fellow. We're going to go through Ebby's visit with Bill, and the way Bill summarizes it in his story is if it's one visit. That's not what happened. There was about 3 or 4 visits, and Ebby didn't show up necessarily by himself. He brought Shep Cornell and Seabird Graves. He even brought Roland Hazard in the Oxford Group circles. He was called the closer. And what they were attempting to do was to pass on what had been so freely given.
They had to, if they wanted to keep it.
Yeah. Now, the difference here is that Ebby and Roland were alcoholics. They were passing on in order to stay sober. But Shep Cornell and Seabird Graves were there because, again, the Oxford Group, this is Bill Wilson. He was the golden boy of Wall Street. If they could help him get sober... It's going to be just like Bud Firestone back in Akron getting sober. It's front page news. This is a big deal for them because the notoriety of pulling Bill Wilson back from the gates was going to make the Oxford Group look very good. But again, first century Christianity, that's what they're preaching here. So I wondered what had gotten into Ebby. He wasn't himself. Come, what's all this about? I queried. He looked simply, straight at me, simply but smilingly, said, Bill, I've got religion.
And at that point, in reality, Bill says, get the hell out of my house. And threw him out. Made three visits, which are not covered in this text. Made three visits.
Bill says, I was aghast. So that was it. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot. Now I suspect a little cracked about religion. Now, there's going to be a parts in this story where we're going to be looking at Bill Wilson, and Ebby and Bill are talking. But there's this inner dialogue that goes on. It's a lot like a tennis match. You know, you got Bill on one side. He's got the vestiges of his old past. He's got the prejudices and all of his old belief systems over here. But yet he's got Ebby here, sober. So you're going to see this back and forth, and this internal struggle with what he knows to be true, and yet what he's seeing is fact.
He's most of the dialogue that you're going to hear from the table up here is a conversation going on in Bill's head. Ebby's just sitting there, and Bill's going, yes, no, no, yes, yes, no. It's back and forth.
Says, he had that starry-eyed look. Yeah, the old boy was on fire, all right. Bless his heart. Let him rant. Besides, my gin will last longer than his preaching.
That's my kind of guy.
But Ebby did know ranting. In a matter-of-fact way, he talked about how two men had appeared in court, persuading the judge to suspend his commitment. You want to talk about Ebby and that?
Ebby, once again, was a blue blood. Thatcher Ironworks came from a lot of money. And he had become an eyesore and an embarrassment to the Thatcher family. And his daddy told him, he said, Ebby, we love you, but you can't be around here no more. People were talking. We got this old place, this old mountain place up in the Berkshires. Why don't you go up there and take care of that old house, Ebby? Just go up there and stay. There's an old car up there you can drive. And Ebby said, fine. He goes up there and he's drinking. And he takes a look at that old place and he says, you know, this thing could use a coat of paint. He got out the bucket and the brushes and he painted that thing. He's real proud of himself. He gets out there and he's looking at the house and these pigeons come by and take a crap on his new paint job.
Mm-mm.
Well, Ebby went inside, and y'all are hunting fellas, I can tell by all the camo. He went inside and pulled out a 10-gauge shotgun to shoot pigeons.
Come on.
So he comes out there and he starts shooting pigeons with a damn 10-gauge shotgun. Sheriff came out and he says, Ebby, we love having you up here. You come from a good family, but you can't be discharging a 10-gauge shotgun up here in these hills. Ebby said, all right, fine. So they let him go. Shortly after that, Ebby was out one morning drinking, of course. He's driving that old car. I picture Ebby probably driving an old Pierce Arrow Roadster or something, wearing that little old skimmer, and lost control of it somehow or another, and ran it right into a woman's house. She's sitting there at the kitchen table eating Cheerios. Car come to rest in her kitchen. He stepped out of the car, kicked some old boards out of the way, doffed his hat, said, morning, ma'am. Good morning for a cup of coffee. Well, the sheriff showed up and says, Ebby,
come on.
You got to go.
Get in the car.
And hauled him off, and that's when he ended up before Judge Collins Graves, Seabra's daddy, and they were locking him up for alcoholic insanity. And so he had been relieved of his commitment, and that's when the Oxford groups had gotten a hold of him and said, you can get and stay sober, but in order to do that, you have to pass this along to yet another alcoholic.
Picking up in that paragraph, it says, they had told Ebby of a simple religious idea and a practical program of action. That was 2 months ago, and the result was self-evident. It worked. Now, here's a time frame for working with a new guy. Ebby's sober 2 months, and he visited Bill Wilson.
I want to drop one more little piece of, I'm a big trivia guy. Ebby Thatcher died sober, and bless you. March 21st of 1966. His longest sobriety was 6 years. He actually got that in a treatment center out in Texas. Bill called Ebby his sponsor up until the date of his death in 1971. And Ebby always told him, he says, Bill, trust the message, but not always the messenger. Because Ebby had a heck of a time staying sober. He really did.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, CRCW out of Dallas, Texas, actually helped get Ebby and pull him, helped try to get him sober, and they ended up taking him back up to the Northeast. And it's just a tough thing, you know. And Ebby always felt like he was part of the foundation of this thing, and he never was. He was never really a member of AA. He was always more or less part of the Oxford group. And, you know, it's a tough thing to watch. Bill considered that as being his sponsor, you know, and Bill really didn't have a sober sponsor for a number of years until Father Dowling?
Yeah, Dowling. And, you know, when if you saw the movie My Name is Bill Dubby, that's a little dramatized. My voice has got a little bit of a ring to it. I have a bell in my head. When he came back from his visit with Dr. Bob in Akron, Ebby was jealous. He wasn't a part of that. He wasn't a part of that. Is that better?
Yeah.
And, you know... Was that your brother? I can't see him. He's so short back there.
Oh, man.
A midget. He's standing up. But when I say he was jealous, it was basically a resentment. He wanted so badly to be a part of it because he's the one that took the message to Bill. And then Bill leaves at New York and he goes over and hooks up with Bob. He never got over that.
Yep.
Let's go.
Bottom of the page says, Ebby had come to pass his experience along to me, and there's a great caveat, if I cared to have it. Anybody try to waste time working with a new guy who does not want to quit drinking? Talk about on page 96, we've talked about on page 100.
I want to ask you on a serious note. I always want to be praying. Not about any information. Isn't Ebby Thatcher an African American?
No.
You
got a picture?
Yeah, but we got a picture.
That was a picture of him, or was he with...
That's a picture of him and Bill.
That is there.
That's the little short guy on this side.
I'm going to look for... I got a picture in here. I'm going to find it.
He does look like you. I like you much... I like you better with the hat on. Nice look. No, you look, without the hat, you really do look like a penis with ears. Hey, John, I get it.
I have enough ears, and that doesn't bother me at all.
Here's an older picture of Ebby.
That's Ebby. That's the last known picture before his death.
He might have been the whitest black man on the planet. All right. Now, Ebby came to share his experience. If I cared to have it, I was shocked but interested. Certainly I was interested. I had to be, for I was hopeless. And again, this is about a month. This is about 2 to 3 weeks before Bill's last drink here. It says, Ebby talked for hours. Childhood memories rose before me. I could almost hear the sound of that preacher's voice as I sat on still Sundays way over there on the hillside. Little background, Bill didn't attend church because as he was growing up, his grandfather had a lot of opinions and old belief systems about the church people and their doings. But one of the things they did is they would sit outside the church and take the people's inventory. Talk about that. He says, there was that proffered temperance, he goes, as I sat on still Sundays way over there on the hillside.
Once again, this argument's going on, I'm sorry.
He says there was that proffered temperance pledge I never signed.
This is the argument going back and forth in Bill's head. He's remembering what his dad said, or his granddad said.
Now, Ebby's bringing religion to the table. That's what he's bringing. He's bringing an organized form of religion. But Bill's got opinions. And he talks about that proffered temperance pledge I never signed. Back when he was in school, in the academy there in Manchester, they had a... temperance pledge. You will not drink. I agree to not drink. Bill wasn't drinking yet. But Bill had a problem with people telling him what to do. And I'm not really keen on you telling me I have to sign this pledge. don't have a problem with the substance of the pledge. I just don't want you to tell me that I have to sign it. You know, it's like that old saying, you can tell an alcoholic, you just can't tell him much. So he says, I was my grandfather's good-natured contempt of some church folk and their doings, his insistence that the spheres really had their music, but his denial of the preacher's right to tell him how he must listen. His fearlessness as he spoke of these things just before he died. These recollections welled up from the past, and they made me swallow hard.
His grandfather had a large role in his life as a child because his father wasn't there. And his grandfather knew about his low self-esteem. And his nickname for Bill was the number one man. He was so proud of Bill. And when the grandfather gave him ideas, Bill listened and he signed on to them. And he's talking about all these things that happened in his childhood that were handed down by his grandfather. They were important. And, you know, how dare he change his mind or his way of thinking? After all, Grandpa Gilman, not Gilman, can't think of his name.
Says they made me swallow hard.
Now, say it.
Yeah. Now, another thing, too, a guy named Mark Whalen was Bill Wilson's mentor and teacher, basically, when he was growing up as a young teenager in East Dorset. Mark Whalen was a college guy, and he came back to East Dorset after going to school every summer, and he told Bill Wilson everything that Bill needed to know about the world around him, how women thought, how science was done, and he was a fascinating guy. And he had problems with organized religion, too. You know, and he was a much more liberal free thinker in a very conservative area of the country, you know, at this point in time. So he says that wartime day in old Winchester Cathedral came back again.
Remember we talked about that on the first page. Something, he said he walked into that cathedral and much moved. Something happened to Bill, and we're going to visit that in a couple of pages.
Now, this is where I can hook up with Bill. He says, I had always believed in a power greater than myself. I'd often pondered these things. I'm not an atheist. Few people really are. But that means a blind faith in the strange proposition that this universe originated in a cipher and aimlessly rushes nowhere. My intellectual heroes, the chemists, the astronomers, even the evolutionists, they suggested vast laws and forces at work. Despite contrary indications, I had little doubt that a mighty purpose and rhythm underlay all. How could there be so much of precise and immutable law and no intelligence?
Bill's really wrestling back and forth with this thing, isn't he?
I simply had to believe in a spirit of the universe who knew neither time nor limitation, but that was as far as I had gone. Now, with ministers in the world's religions, I parted right there. When they talked of a God personal to me, who is love, superhuman strength, and direction, I became irritated and my mind snapped shut against such a theory.
Boy, he was pissed about that.
To Christ, I conceded the certainty of a great man, not too closely followed by those who claimed him. Those damn hypocrites. His moral teaching, most excellent. For myself, I had adopted those parts which seemed convenient, not too difficult. The rest I disregarded. Now, this is where Bill's going to be pulling from. Anybody got a perception problem? We look at... all right. I can really hook up with this part. Because Bill's looking through life through his alcoholic lenses. He says, the wars which had been fought, the burnings and chicanery that religious dispute had facilitated made me sick.
And those things are still going on today. You remember that fateful day in September when those two airplanes flew into the Twin Towers? Remember that day? That's religious dispute. All the dying, all the bloodshed on the North Bank, all the bloodshed in Northern Ireland, Protestants and Catholics. If you don't believe the way I believe, I'm going to kill you.
Yeah, there's a talk by Clancy. I mentioned this to somebody last night. It's the Beginner's Roundup, and he's speaking at Scotland, but he refers back to a time in when he spoke in Belfast, and he says that when they were speaking, he would stop every now and then because the building would shake from the explosions, and he could hear the machine gun fire outside. And he looked around the room, and he said something that was so profound. He says, this room contains Catholics and Protestants who are unified under a single message. They're not killing each other. You know, and outside that room, all bets are off. But inside that room, inside the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, we're here together saving lives. And a lot of, in the Deep South in the 50s, in the late 40s and 50s, a lot of white men put themselves in harm's way by going to pick up a black alcoholic and bring him to a meeting. you know, and that racial divide was there very prominently there then, and it still exists to some extent now. But I mean, there was just, I mean, alcoholism does not discriminate. It's one of the most unifying of diseases, you know.
And we talk about the religious dispute. I mean, look what's happening in Israel. It's been happening there since there was just rocks there. It's been good. I mean, as long as I can remember, there's been wars going on in Israel. But a really cool fact, to put a high note at the end of this kind of a somber moment, is that we just learned that there's 150,000 sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in the mosques in Iran. How cool is that? Bring the pain.
Now, this is where Bill and I can hook up again. I honestly doubted whether, on balance, the religions of mankind had done any good. Judging from what I'd seen in Europe and since, the power of God in human affairs was negligible, the brotherhood of man a grim jest. If there was a devil, he seemed the boss universal, and he certainly had me. So Bill's got all these belief systems. And it's weird, if you have a certain belief system that's so firmly entrenched, and you see something that goes against your belief system, well, it can't possibly be true. Because my belief system tells me it's got to be this way. But see, Bill says the same thing. But my friend, Ebbie, sat before me. He certainly, he says, and he made the point-blank declaration, God had done for him what he could not do for himself.
He had had a religious experience.
Ebbie's human will had failed. Doctors pronounced him incurable. Society about to lock him up. Like me, he had admitted complete defeat. Then, Ebbie had, in effect, been raised dead. Suddenly taken from the scrap heap to a level of life better than the best he had ever known.
In my margin, I wrote these words, that Ebbie's message had depth and weight. When my brother came to me, and I was homeless and dying in the street in September of 1987, I didn't have to say, Bub, are you an alcoholic? Hell, I knew he was. We ran together. And he says, I am a man with a real solution, and I can introduce you to a group of people that can give you a life far better than your wildest dream. I didn't have any choice. I had to listen. I didn't know about drugs. I didn't have the option of a treatment center. I needed to go ahead and kick and get my life together, and he showed me how to do that through you. So when Ebbie showed up, Bill was dying, 40 pounds underweight. And Ebbie says, I have a solution for you, Bill. And he said, help me out, please.
There's a line in To Employers, it says, it meant that I would have to let go of several lifelong conceptions. And then there's another line in working with in How It Works that says, some of us tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil. Ebbie Thatcher was trying to put a new idea onto a closed brain. Because Bill knew everything he needed to know about God, he knew everything he needed to know about religion, and he's just elaborated on that right there. But he's got Ebbie, and then he asks the question, had this power originated in Ebbie? Obviously, it hadn't. There was no more power in Ebbie than there was in me at that minute, and this was none at all. That floored me. It began to look as though religious people were right after all. Here was something at work in a human heart, which had done the impossible. The ideas about miracles were drastically revised right then. Never mind the musty past. Here sat a miracle directly across the kitchen table. And Ebbie shouted great tidings.
And Ebbie wasn't shouting. Ebbie was just sitting there saying, I don't drink anymore. I don't have to drink anymore, Bill. I hadn't had a drink in a couple of months.
Yeah. Now, I saw that my friend was much more than inwardly reorganized. Ebbie was on a different footing. His roots grasped a new soil. Now, back to tennis match. We got to knock it back over Wilson's selfish, self-centered side. Despite the living example of Ebbie, there remained in me the vestiges of my old prejudice.
All right. This word prejudice is going to take a strong hold into this book study. And if you've got a pen, I invite you to write this definition down because it'll help explain a lot of things. Bill's hanging on to his old ideas. The word prejudice means it's a preconceived idea that disallows new information. Bill has a preconceived idea disallow the new information that was being given him by his childhood friend, Ebbie Thatcher. It says, the word God still aroused a certain antipathy. Antipathy is anger, resentment, hostility. Anytime, that was the way with me. For years, I walked around the planet, even sober, And somebody would say Christ or Jesus or Christianity, and I would bristle. And my sponsor says, dude, we need to work through this. And he gave me some books to read. And then God found it fit that I sit in a car from Atlanta, Georgia, to St. Simon's Island. And this guy was a Baptist, basically almost a deacon from Alabama. And this guy had that Bible with the tissue paper pages in it and the red writing, and everything in that damn thing was highly underlined. And he brought that old ugly Bible with him on this trip. And he helped me to get okay with Christ, Christianity,